I often use Stan as my warm-up speaker. Why would anybody be so foolish as to agree to speak after his introduction? Before I start, I need to tell a Don Lipsett story. This is one that I don't think any of you would have had a chance to hear, with the exception of Ken Cribb. I think I told this to him maybe a year or so ago. The preface to this story is that Don was well aware that my wife Helen and I knew of the general nature of the blood disease that was eventually to take him from us. Now that's just a little part of the background that becomes relevant to the story later. About 15 or 16 years ago, I had occasion to go over to the world headquarters of the Philadelphia Society in North Adams on an errand of great importance, I'm sure, to the international situation. I arrived there about 3:15 in the afternoon, at which time, of course, the Commodore was just getting around. That was the morning part of his day. And I asked him about that. I said, you're just getting up. I was generally aware that he was a man of the night, but 3:15 seemed to me a little excessive. And he said, somebody's got to watch out for the Ruskies. Well, okay, that was fine. I accepted that, and I was grateful for his vigilance. Just a little over 2 years ago, in an exchange of notes relating to society business, I don't even remember what it was, I wrote back to him on the bottom of the whatever form he wanted me to sign, I called you the other day, and you mentioned that you were just getting around, and this was about 3:15 in the afternoon. I said, I want to remind you that the evil empire is no more, at least that version of the evil empire. Is there one that I don't know about that you're staying up to watch for at this point? And I wrote this, and he sent me back the next day a note with a scrawl across the top, I'm watching for Dr. Kevorkian. I think that not only says something about Don, but about the culture of our times. Some of you, my friends and colleagues in this society for more than 20 years, know what an honor and what a privilege it is for me to introduce this path-breaking meeting. Bill Campbell tells me that it's the largest regional meeting in the 32-year history of the Philadelphia Society. Now, without a doubt, that is due to the fantastic drawing power of my name. It has nothing to do with Williamsburg, or that we're here to discuss the origins of our republic, or that we have assembled a remarkable group of the most promising young scholars in the country. And most of you will be glad to know that the title of these remarks, Was There a Founding?, does not imply that I'm about to rehearse an old debate between some conservatives and some Straussians about whether America is unfounded or founded. That debate is interesting, and it's a lot of fun, and it's always important. Certainly, Mel Bradford and Harry Jaffa had a good time with it several years ago. But tonight, I want to give instead an exhortation primarily to the scholars that we will hear tomorrow, but also to the society and to the academy in general. The exhortation is based on the conviction that we are now closer to, or at least potentially closer to, a recovering our past than we have been in over 7 decades. Stan Evans recently told me about a conversation he had with the great Richard Weaver in Indianapolis about 1960. Stan asked him at that meeting what was needed to keep the conservative momentum going after the revival of ideas that Weaver was so instrumental in bringing about. And Richard Weaver said to him, we need unshakable books. Unshakable books. Books so compelling and elegant and true that they survive all challenges and the ravages of time. Now, Richard Weaver said this, remember, only one decade after Lionel Trilling had pronounced the absence of conservative and reactionary ideas in America. He said, if you remember, there are none of these in currency. There are only irritable mental gestures seeking to resemble ideas. Well, now, in 1996, I'm happy to report to you that there are no liberal or progressive ideas currently in general circulation in America, at least not that mean anything. They were used up in the 60s. To paraphrase Trilling, there are only Pollyannish or tyrannical mental gestures seeking to resemble ideas. Now, this doesn't mean that it's entirely clear in which direction we're going. Daniel Boone's biographer recently told a story about the old hunter. A young interviewer asked Boone, when he was an old man, if he had ever been lost. Well, Boone thought for a minute, and he said, well, no, but I once was bewildered for 3 days. Well, Boone may well have been bewildered about the American founding. During the War for Independence, he lost his son Israel in a disastrous and very ill-considered attack at the Battle of Blue Licks in Kentucky. He was accused of treason. He was tried in a court-martial and exonerated. Neither the Commonwealth of Virginia nor the United States Congress sympathized with his debt problems, many of them occurring because of his service to either Virginia or the United States, nor did they sympathize with his applications for land grants. And so he eventually moved into Spanish territory, pretty ambivalent for a time, not for long, but pretty ambivalent for a time about the future of his country. Well, as things were then uncertain for Boone about looking ahead, they are also complicated and it seems to me sometimes bewildering for us looking back. As a matter of fact, I often wish there were more honest bewilderment in our profession, in my profession. But we have brought here this weekend together some of the ablest young scholars who are thinking about ideas, and especially ideas concerning our founding. As a matter of fact, if Mount Williamsburg were to erupt this weekend and bury the old Capitol, I think the prospects for recovering that founding would be dim indeed. This program is a first for this increasingly venerable organization. But notice that unless we allow the kids to be home alone, the sessions are chaired by folks of my generation. That is, people born after the Great Crash and before December 6, 1941. We have fought against the pagan forces of Leviathan. We have battled new dealers and fair dealers and no dealers. We took on the vital center and the end of ideology and have shown that all reports of our death are premature. And we have not gone away. We have bequeathed to this generation unshakable books and the deconstruction of deconstruction. And if there's one thing we have to charge them with this weekend is, see then that ye walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Now, the next generation, both of scholars and of citizens, must deal, of course, with boomer books, as I like to call them, and also the legacy of the left's long march through the institutions. On one level, the next generation has a task that was easier than ours. After all, how much problem can it be intellectually to annihilate the Clinton generation and its rather pathetic offspring, multiculturalism? On the other hand, you of the next generation have almost invincible ignorance to combat. I have found that over the course of my 22 years teaching at Hillsdale College, that almost three-quarters of our freshmen have not, when they come to me, read the Constitution of the United States or the Declaration of Independence. Now, let me say that again. About three-quarters have not read the Constitution of the United States or the Declaration of Independence. I'm not talking about studying. They have not read it, either one. What do you suppose the percentage is at Appalachian State or even at William and Mary, or in the White House. Now, as a teacher, I used to worry about this, but it's actually a bad news, good news situation. The bad news is that they haven't read the documents. The good news is that they haven't read the documents, at least taught to them by people who think the American Revolution was a multicultural event. In a way, the generation following yours is a forest of virgin timber. We have held off the clear cutters of the left and have destroyed or rendered obsolete most of their tools. And so it should be, or it can be, it should be, I hope, your forest to harvest. Not that it's an easy task. 75 years ago, progressive ideas, almost all of them, of course, collectivist and relativist, about the founding and about most other subjects, but about the founding, swept through the habitats of elite culture in this country. Charles Beard, we all know, was one of the apostles, and he wanted us to believe that the founding was eventually about greed. Walter Lippmann made a comment in 1923 that could have saved us a great deal of pain. Far from creating the Constitution to protect their property, he said, the founders used their class privileges to preserve their country. Now, this was apparently too much common sense, because it took a full generation later that an unshakable book by Forrest MacDonald finally laid these particular forces of neo-Marxism to rest. But you know, just as failed socialism in recent years has put on a new political disguise, environmentalism, progressives keep grasping and re-grasping at the founding. Their headings are more likely now to be race, class, and gender than the old heading, which was the revolution considered as a social movement, but the point is the same. They still talk about the compelling image of revolutionary transformation, and it's exciting to a whole new generation of neo-progressives. They still believe that the founding was, quote, as radical and as revolutionary as any in history. Now, those are quotations from two very recent books attempting to keep this progressive view going. Now, I've spent a lot of time in the past three decades trying to find that change they keep, that transforming, transfiguring change they keep talking about, and I can't find it on the whole. I keep looking. Not long ago, as a matter of fact, it was only 2 weeks ago, I discovered an example, a notable social event, I think you'd say. The Loyalist Anglican rector of Trinity Church, you know, the church that owns Wall Street. His name was Samuel Akmoni, and he was part of this notable social event. Fleeing New York, and this here I'm quoting Clifford Shipton in his wonderful little short biography of him. His critics were amused to see his house immediately taken over by female camp followers of the regulars for a place of business. Now, I guess that's social change. Think about it. And of course, George Washington did try to fix wages and prices in areas controlled by the Continental Army, prompting John Witherspoon to criticize him severely on behalf of the Congress. But neither episode lasted long. Now, I'm particularly annoyed when neo-progressives make their revolutionary case or take their refuge in something that I like to call the touched-off or the made-possible theory of the American Revolution. The founding touched off the anti-slavery movement, for example, or it made possible the movements for women's rights in the 19th century. Now, aside from the sheer logical silliness of this argument, if we want to take that far enough, everything, of course, was touched off in the book of Genesis. Do we really need to be reminded that the United States was one of the last civilized countries to abolish slavery, and then only after a war, which really was a revolution in certain undebatable ways? Or that every argument ever made by women's rights movements ever made, including today, was written down by Mary Wollstonecraft by 1792, who had nothing whatsoever to do with the American Revolution or the American founding. In fact, most of what is really important about the American founding lies in how a potentially destructive revolution was contained. It was not entirely averted, not by a long shot, but it was contained and directed to the ends of limited government and the practice of liberties that had long existed in most American provinces. David Hackett Fisher tells this story, and here I'll quote from him. Historian George Bancroft, this is approximately 50 years after the American Revolution, asked a New England townsman why he and his friends took up arms in the Revolution. Had he been inspired by the ideas of John Locke? Well, the old soldier confessed that he'd never heard of Locke. Had he been moved by Thomas Paine's common sense? The honest Yankee admitted that he never read Tom Paine. Had the Declaration of Independence made all the difference? The veteran thought not. And when asked to explain why he fought in his own words, he answered simply that New Englanders had always managed their own affairs, and the British tried to stop them, and so the war began. Now, this old Yankee's attitude, I think, helps to explain why a potential revolution could be contained. There's nothing very revolutionary about him. But it doesn't explain how that attitude was converted successfully into a relatively stable republic. We should note here that progressive historians have the same advantage as their political counterparts. In pursuit of what, again, Forrest MacDonald has called their dogmatic, scientific, secular millennialism, if a progressive program doesn't work, it's because it hasn't been tried ardently enough. The touched-off or the made-possible historians won't leave their dreams of social transformation until they have gotten grants to study every backcountry settlement, slave cabin, Iroquois, longhouse, sailor's wharf, and household kitchen in Revolutionary America. In contrast, I think the men and women on these panels this weekend take ideas and the public record seriously. Once in a while, you find a progressive who learns to do this from experience. Theodore White, Teddy White of the Making of the President series, reflecting many years later on his confrontation with real revolution in Yunnan during World War II, said this. This is in his autobiography, In Search of History. It's a wonderful book, by the way. You can learn an awful lot about the 20th century from this, not necessarily agreeing with it, simply learning from it. He said this, in the simplest historic terms, Mao was not campaigning against Chiang Kai-shek. He was campaigning against Confucius and 2,000 years of ideas he meant to root out and replace with his own. Now, White was unusual, an intellectually honest progressive who eventually gave up on his visionary agenda and learned how right John Dickinson was when he said to the Federal Convention of 1787, experience must be our only guide, reason may mislead us. Now, Dickinson's wise counsel brings me to what I really want to say tonight, and I'll say it briefly. In continuing to take ideas seriously, as they are held by people, ideas do not exist in some abstract realm without people holding them, and contained in the public record and in the great documents of the founding and in its law and literature, we are engaged in a great act of recovery. The experience to which Dickinson referred was the common experience of his or by extension any generation in their solemn deliberations, that is, the tests of history and common sense. Experience was the ubiquitous criterion of the ages, this is Ellis Sandoz's phrase, and the cardinal touchstone of validity for his generation. Dickinson wrote a note to himself for one of his convention speeches. The best philosophy is drawn from experiments, the best policy from experience. The founders, or most of them, knew that they were doing something profound, or they never would have used the phrase Novus Ordo Seclorum. But they knew they were doing it in a way that was consistent with the wisdom of the ages. Now, I like to shorthand the sources of their understanding of liberty, the sources of the ideas, in four categories. There are more than these, and we can refine them. But I think four elements of their common experience appear in all of the founders' debates and writings and documents. The first is classical history, especially the history of the Roman Republic, often as it was filtered through Renaissance and Enlightenment authors. The second was the Bible, which they read as history as well as theology. The third was the English common law, which they felt was the repository of the natural law as well as of English liberties. And fourth, their own colonial history, American colonial history, containing by then lessons from a century and a half of managing their own affairs. That so much of their discussion was conducted in this context shows that they were engaged in recovering as well as founding, of protecting liberty at least as much and probably much more than in inventing it. Now, they were as serious about what could be learned from the fate of the Amphictyonic Council or the Achaean League as we should be about their arguments over imitating foreign fashions. They thought that stable and secure and decent governments devoted to the protection of liberty must be based on truths of human nature revealed in experience. Truths of human nature revealed in experience. And it seems to me that our unshakable books should emulate their enterprise. John Adams once said about the American and French revolutions, ours was resistance to innovation, theirs was innovation itself. Now, this was a flippant comment of his, certainly. It nevertheless captures an important truth. Insofar as it was successful, the American founding was rooted in ancient truths. It was not attempting to touch off a transfiguration of the world. Now, let me finish this exhortation with an example and a suggestion. I've tried for many years, for 3.5 decades now, to teach the American founding by inviting my students into the lives of our philosopher statesmen, and then into the rich things that they wrote. A teacher, and especially a teacher of freshmen, cannot do this with big books, at least not right away, however unshakable they might be. I've recently written 4 little books, hoping to prepare students to read with profit the greater works of unshakable scholarship my generation has produced. But I found this, and I've found this to be very interesting, that even the generally conservative and often religious students at Hillsdale College are infected with what Perry Miller once called obtuse secularism. It's pretty hard for them to connect liberty and religion in a way that will help effect a recovery of our past. They want either to put a wall of separation between the two, as the Supreme Court instructs them to, or to believe that the founders were empowered by the Almighty to create and proclaim a Christian nation. Now, that Christianity and the Bible was at the heart of the founding is simply undeniable. The controversy over a resident bishop consumed at least as much ink as the Stamp Act. The constitutions of the states and of the United States are nothing if not written expressions of the Christian view of human nature. In every one of the first 20 years of independent national existence, governments at all levels proclaimed days of fasting, prayer, and thanksgiving. The churches, even a majority of the Anglican priests, overwhelmingly supported the war for independence. The definition of liberty preferred by Americans was biblical. They shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. John Adams said in 1818, and by this time he was a Unitarian, that the Revolution was over before the war began. It was a change in the religious sentiments of the American people. So important, in fact, if we go a little bit behind this, was the Great Awakening to later events that it's very tempting to parody Mark Twain. Twain once said that Sir Walter Scott caused the Civil War. We might add that George Whitefield preached the American Revolution. Now, this does not mean that even the most enthusiastic ministers thought that the founding created a holy commonwealth. But it does mean that the deism of Benjamin Rush or Tom Paine dramatically failed to become the faith of the Republic. It does mean that the ambivalent Unitarian Jefferson was profoundly out of step with his countrymen religiously, and that a crucial part of our act of recovery is to show again the right relation between religion and liberty. Now, in this regard, notice this. The Reverend Dr. John Witherspoon, president of Princeton, signer of the Declaration, member of Congress, teacher of statesmen, a principal author of the Presbyterian Constitution, has had one biography written of him in the 202 years since his death, and that was written in 1925. The Reverend Dr. Timothy Dwight, president of Yale, epic poet, chronicler of New England, and widely regarded in his time as New England's second citizen, second only to John Adams, has inspired one biography since his death in 1817, and that was written in 1939. We can and must make a long list of heroes and villains, by the way, whose ideas and deeds have literally been lost for generations. And I pray that someone will write these characters into unshakable books. We don't have to claim unreasonable things. We don't have to claim that the American founding was somehow conservative in its essence. We don't have to claim that America was somehow Christian at its core to make our point and to effect a recovery. There were radicals around, French-style Jacobins even, and they had their followers. And there were plenty of enlightened deists and Unitarians willing to take Christianity to new heights of progress. But a remarkable generation of founders, not inventors, but founders, contained them all and built and protected institutions based on ideas about liberty and truths about human nature that are as old as God. Do good work this weekend. Advance the cause of recovery. End of exhortation. Thank you very much.
I want to thank John Wilson for just a superb keynote and summary, really, of what this entire enterprise is about. There's no further business to transact except to repeat the injunction that if you are not registered, please do so, and please sign up for the buses so we can get a count for tomorrow evening. And with that, the drinking lamp is lit. We are adjourned. Thank you all.